Welcome to Food, Farms, and Chefs radio show, where we highlight everyone from the top industry leaders to startups and farmers that make it all possible with Chef Jean Blum and photojournalist Amaris Pollock. Hi, and welcome back to Food, Farms, and Chefs. We are actually going to be starting a whole brand new show. It's relatively soon, but for now, I want to introduce all of you to Reese Powell, who is the founder and owner of Red Rabbit. Reese, welcome to Food, Farms, and Chefs.
Afternoon, Amaris. Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you as well. So I did some, I always go into researching the people who are joining me on the show, and you, by leaps and bounds, have a very impressive background and resume, including the first time I've ever had somebody on who's from, who went to school at MIT. So I have to applaud you because I know that is a very rigorous like college to get into and graduate from. So props to you for doing that. But we, of course, we focus on food on our show. And so I kind of am interested in a little bit about your background and how you kind of liaisoned into what you do, what Red Rabbit does for the community.
Sure. I'll start. You know, the Red Rabbit story is interesting. There are a few pivots we've had in our time that I think kind of tell the story quite well. When I get back to the beginning of the story, and I think this will tie into my time at MIT too, I was working in finance on Wall Street, and a friend of mine was struggling to get healthy food for his four-year-old who was in school here in New York City. And he asked me to help him find a company or find a solution. I was at the time the most food conscious or food aware person in my social group with all my friends. And so we did a little bit of research and we didn't find anything that was really suitable for what he was looking for. And so that was the original impetus to start Red Rabbit. So I kind of moved away from finance and I jumped into entrepreneurship. And we started the company then. Originally, we served mostly independent schools in New York City. And a couple years in, I found myself as the lunch lady at a school in downtown, at an independent school in downtown Manhattan. So for about 3 hours a day during lunch, I was in the cafeteria and I served about 150 kids in the cafeteria at lunch every day.
Oh, wow.
And you know, it was, the short story is that it was the most engaged and present time of my life to that date. So I was in my mid-20s at the time. You know, I always tell this story. I was about an 11-year-old, I think. So it was an elementary and middle school. And an 11-year-old, she came up to me and she said, Reese, how old are you? And I said, I'm 26. And she said, do you have a girlfriend? And I said, no. And she looked at me for a second and she goes, you should get working on that. but for me, you know, coming out of high school, I went to MIT, which, as you mentioned, is a pretty rigorous and a demanding environment to be in. And straight out of MIT, I went to work on Wall Street, which is a similarly competitive and rigorous, demanding environment. And so the contrast against those environments, which was really all that I knew coming out of high school and leaving home with being inside of a lunchroom, serving, you know, kids between 5 and 11 years old during lunchtime and having really nothing else to do and nowhere else to go but to be present with them and engage with them. That's where I started to really fall in love with hospitality and the hospitality industry. And that's kind of where I kind of fell in love with the idea of Red Rabbit and the work we were doing. That original, just to give you the pivots in Red Rabbit, that original model, though, a few years into the company, I started to learn a little bit more about the industry. So before I started, I hadn't known much about education. I didn't have any experience with food really other than being someone who loved to eat. And so the more I learned about the industry, the more I learned about school food, the more I learned about our food system, I started to realize that children in public schools were really getting the short end of the stick when it came to school food. And so we pivoted the company at that time to go away from serving independent schools and really shift towards serving schools in the public school system. Yeah. The challenge there for us was to take this meal, which was, you know, about a $6 meal, and bring it down to $3 and kind of do that while maintaining the nutritive qualities of the meal, while maintaining the quality and the deliciousness and the presentation of the meal. And so that really was one of the biggest pivots in Red Rabbit, in Red Rabbit history. And then the second one came probably about 6 years ago. And it was, again, looking at the industry and us getting a lot deeper into the history of the industry and how school food works, and seeing that the majority of the kids that we served were Black and Latino kids in the public school system, and realizing and then really delving into what is the history of that and how did that evolve. And that put us smack dab into a conversation about social justice and civil rights. And so really pivoting the company and evolving our messaging to understand that it's more than just the food that we were serving to the kids. We were actually doing, we had a responsibility to uplift and affirm the kids in the cafeteria. We have this unique position, which I think all kind of restaurateurs and folks in the hospitality industry understand about food, is that it is a place where we commune, we come together, we find ourselves, we seek solace, we seek community. And so we really dug into that responsibility and started to see ourselves as a social justice organization, kind of uplifting students of color in schools. And those two pivots kind of tell the story, I think, about Red Rabbit. You know, it articulates the story in quite a clear way and kind of explains how we got to where we are now.
Yeah. And I mean, representation in not just, you know, a school setting, but also what you consume, and knowing that you can consume food that is, you know, offered in school that's healthy and, you know, helps give you your body nutrients so you can actually continue, you know, having that energy to learn is, you know, pivotal for the scholastic system as well. And I read it on your website that one of your big things is to make sure that the culture is represented in the school. So I thought that was very poignant as well. But so what are some of the foods that you offer in, you know, how many schools do you serve?
Sure. I don't know the exact number now. I know we're in, we serve about 45,000 meals a day, and the cities we're in, we're usually in urban environments, so typically underserved communities. Right now, that's communities like the South Bronx in New York City, Newark in New Jersey, Southwest Philly in Philadelphia. We're in Northeast Philly in Philadelphia, and soon we'll be launching in Ward 7 and 8 in D.C. So those are the communities we serve, and the type of foods that we serve are really deliberately designed to reflect the culture of the kids that we serve. So, you know, we are from those same communities too. When you look at the makeup of the organization, we're Black owned, and our chefs, we hire our chefs from those communities. And so it gives them a sense of familiarity with the culture and with the food that kids enjoy. And one of the things that we do when we go into a new school, and generally in a new community, but specifically into a new school, is we ask the children, what did their parents eat? What does their family eat when they're celebrating? When you guys have celebrations, what are the meals that you eat? And we take that feedback. And like I said, usually the chefs are from those communities too, so there's immediate camaraderie there and kind of connection. But we take that feedback, and that's what we use to build the menus for the schools. And the school menus. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's key too. And I actually was going to bring in how do you acquire? I don't want to say acquire, but how do you find the chefs that are involved in the process?
You know, we really go into the community and we look for them. I think most of our chefs come from really refined culinary backgrounds. You know, they're usually working in restaurants, some in fine dining, some in high-end catering. And when we present them, or when we offer them the roles and we present it to them, we're offering them an opportunity to give back to the communities that they came from. And that's something that they find really attractive. So the idea that they can take the skills that they've developed in the culinary world and use those skills to provide meals for kids in school. And for a lot of them, they see a reflection of themselves inside of those kids. And I mean, Our chefs they're real chefs. And I listened to your show and I've heard some of the chefs that you interview. And when they talk about food, it just elevates your spirit. And, you know, you start to get hungry, but there's even more than hunger, right? There's a sense of artistry and aspiration when real chefs talk about food. And those are the types of chefs we put inside schools, which is very unique when it comes to school food, that you're going to have chefs who aren't just following a script or checking down a list of compliance requirements or meals they have to serve because the state said they have to serve it. But instead, you have chefs who are bringing in artistry, who are bringing in love, who are bringing in passion, and they see the kids that they serve every day as their customers, as their clientele, and they're trying to uplift them as much as they can.
Of course. Now, one thing that I'm wondering about, because obviously you're providing the fully packaged meals presented in front of for kids to consume, but I'm wondering if part of your programming offers or something, maybe an initiative that you can get inspired from me, but that these chefs that go in and create these meals that are, you know, reflective of the community that they're serving, whether or not you have students learning how to prepare those meals from those chefs.
Absolutely. Our chef, it brings up to mind a chef, and he's actually in Northeast Philly, and he does a class every week. It's a high school, so he works with high school students, and it's essentially a culinary class that he does inside the school. And kids learn, they learn some of the basics. So they learn how to run a professional kitchen, basics around food safety, how to handle equipment, how to handle and be safe around the fire. And then, of course, this chef in particular, his name's Javier. He's I'll tell you a little bit about him. He's a really interesting background, too. He grew up in Peru, his mother is, or his parents were Japanese and Spanish. And so his household had a plethora and a bounty of food cultures and food tastes. And when he travels quite a bit. He always brings back foods from the places that he's traveled and then makes those recipes for his kids in the school. He's one of the most dynamic and energetic chefs you'll ever meet. But in this class, he works with the kids and he pulls from their history and their culture to help them understand how to make the meals that are familiar to them. So he gives them a transparency into that process. And then he sprinkles it in with food techniques that he's learned from around the world and gives them more exposure then on food. And kids, when they leave his class every year, they're little mini culinarians, of course, jumping out of his course there. So that's something that we really love to do. And especially once you start to get to the older kids, the high school kids, they really are engaged and motivated by being a part of the process.
Yeah. And I love that. I love that so much. And I actually have a friend who teaches at a tech school that's a high school, and there's three different levels and three different chefs that work within that community. And they do the same thing. They teach their food insecure individuals who are students that are coming to these classes, and they don't have the knowledge, and the school that they work with, they teach these students how to cook, and it's such a beautiful thing that they do. And it sounds like Javier is doing the same. With that being said, what you provide, what Red Rabbit provides, is an opportunity to feed, nutrient dense, like very good foods to, students who are then seeing meals that they would normally see at home inside the school, which previously didn't happen. So are you, constantly kind of reaching out and expanding that program?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, we're currently in those cities that I mentioned. We're in Philadelphia every year. So we're coming on the new school year now. We're reaching out to schools around Philadelphia and expanding the program there. So looking at the communities that, you mentioned, underserved and underprivileged, where this type of kind of high quality food society just hasn't been structured in a way to provide it or to make it an offering in those communities. Yeah. And so we're calling them and we're saying, hey, we'd like to come into your community. We'd like to come into your school. Come take a look at what we're doing at a school in Northeast Philly. Come take a look at what we're doing at a school in Southwest Philadelphia. If this is something you want for your kids, if this is something that you want to see inside your community, please give us a call. And I think what's one of the great things about our program is that schools usually benefit in addition to the kids benefiting. There's a yeah. ripple effect that happens when you have energy and dynamism inside the cafeteria. That reminds me of a story of a school here in New York in the South Bronx. They have about 300 kids. They're predominantly English language learners. And before we came into the cafeteria, they had about 15 children eating lunch every day. Mm-hmm. We started in August, and within 2 months, the consumption inside that school went up to practically the entire school. I think it was 290 kids every day, but not wow. just kids. The teachers were also eating the food too, because who doesn't want to have a chef, essentially your own chef, cooking food for your lunch every day? And the head of the school came up to me one day and she said, you know, Reese, this change that you guys have done in the cafeteria has really just changed our entire school community. It has really changed the culture of our school. And so that's something that we get from a lot of our schools, that it goes beyond just the food in the cafeteria, but we're having an impact on the culture and the community.
Of course. And I'm sure, like, to a certain degree, you know, now that, you know, you're putting in place provisions for them to be fed nutritional meals and, you know, showing cultural and heritage that they're, you know, they resonate with. You're also, you know, probably like upticking test scores and, you know, just their involvement, their engagement, their focus and drive as well. Cause, you know, not to cliche this, but like, you are what you eat. And if you're eating well, you're gonna perform better. So I have to applaud you for that. So, just out of curiosity, are there programs like outreaches or whatnot that you can do during the summertime too?
Yes. You know, we work with a lot of, food banks and summer programs during the summer. I think most recently last year, we did a huge program with, Food Bank of South Jersey during the summer, serving a lot of schools down in South Jersey, kind of rooted in Camden, but then expanding out. And that's typical for us during the summer. A lot of the schools we work with have some type of summer programs also, where yeah. children come to school during the summer. And so we're very active in that. So we're happy to do those types of programs if schools need them and if they want to reach out.
Of course. And so if somebody was interested in volunteering, you know, do you take them through a almost like a training program too? And how would they be able to join this program?
Yeah, just reach out to us. You know, we're everywhere that you would expect. You can go to myredrabbit.com, and on our website, we have a contact page. We're a big company, but we're not a big company. So if you reach out with a question or a request, you know, it'll usually get to the right person. You can find us on IG, myredrabbit, at myredrabbit. You can find us on LinkedIn at myredrabbit, or you can give us a call. You know, we straddle that line between, you know, community-based organization, non-for-profit, and a for-profit organization. You know, our goal is to change the school food system entirely. Our goal is to bring in uplift and cultural affirmation into the school system. And so while we do run as a disciplined and rigorous business, we also kind of have our nose to the grindstone, and we're connected to the community. So if anyone reaches out, we'll respond. We love volunteers to come in, and we love folks who share that passion, that sense of, you know, using food to bring community together and to uplift children.
Of course. Well, Reese, unfortunately, time flies by and we are, you know, out of time. So thank you so much for joining us on the show. And I look forward to seeing you expand your business.
Thank you, Amherst. You know, one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about, if you have 30 seconds, is the actual meals that the kids get. I didn't get to mention it. And I know.
I did want to mention that too. So, yeah.
And I know on your show, chefs talk so brilliantly about food that kids eat. So I'll just mention a few real quickly. You know, one of the meals that we're really proud about is our jollof rice. It's something that a chef from Brooklyn made. And we asked her the question, you know, what food would you have liked to eat when you were in school that would have made you feel whole and seen? And that was really popular. We have a pastelone, which is a lovely dish. It's mostly Puerto Rican and Dominican, and, you know, it's made with plantains, which we cook it for 2 days, and we layer it with meat, and it is absolutely delicious. And then most recently, we had a new dish add to our menu, which was a jerk salmon. So we have a chef who's from Jamaican American descent, and she made a jerk salmon at home and then decided one day, you know, I really want to cook this for my kids in school, and went through the process of cooking it for her kids. And that too was just fantastic. So those are just some samples of meals that we cook for the kids in school. I wanted you to get that before we signed out.
Thank you so much. And on that note, I thank you for joining us, and we will be right back after this short break.
To become a sponsor of Food Farms and Chefs and have your business or event promoted on two radio stations in Philadelphia that play on Tuesdays during Drive Time Radio and on a station in New York on Fridays at 1 p.m., you can email us at foodfarmsandchefs@yahoo.com, ibfoodie2@yahoo.com, or arpolicus@gmail.com.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. I have Zach Posman, who is the owner and head baker of Brass Monkey Bread Co., joining us, and I am so grateful for you to join us today. Thank you so much for being on Food Farms and Chefs.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I want to make a little bit of a pun because we're going to get a rise out of you. Ha ha. But you're also a sixth grade school teacher at Conwell Middle School. So what is it like to be a teacher and creating breads and whatnot? Almost, I feel like the students from some of the videos that have the foods, the cookies and stuff like that, a little bit as like a reward program.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I actually quit teaching at the end of last year to take this full time. So it's been a really crazy journey so far. But when I was teaching, sometimes I used the sweets as a cookie, but other times I would bring in bread and a toaster oven and we would have breakfast in the mornings.
I mean, so, I wouldn't be mad at that if I came into school right. But I've always been into food. So I probably... I would have loved that.
I would always bring them something. Yeah. I miss working with the kids, but I'll get back eventually with working with kids.
Of course. Especially because I'm sure you don't go into it to like without the passion to teach. So
yeah, absolutely.
Now, that being said, how did you get into this? Because that's a different leeway than most people.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I'm a glutton for punishment. I go from one hard job to the other. It was during the pandemic and, you know, I needed something to do. And a friend of mine said, let's try sourdough because that's what everyone's into. I actually gave up for a little while because my starter died and things weren't coming out well. My friend Katie forced me to continue. And I was doing things. I was calling myself the bread bandit during the pandemic. I would drive around and just put bread on people's doors and knock and run away. And so it just kind of went from there. And then I started taking orders and... you know, getting out there and doing pop-ups. And so, yeah, it's been a crazy, crazy, crazy journey. And now I'm full-time. I just got my first person about a month and a half ago to help me.
Oh, nice. So yeah. Like your first employee. Now, are you still creating everything out of the kitchen in your house or do you have a prep kitchen that you're working with?
So I don't have a prep kitchen yet. I'm in my basement right now, but I am looking to be out of here within the next like month or two. Actually, okay. I'm looking into commissaries right now. I might have a great opportunity out of a school that's here in Philly. Lots of things are happening pretty quickly, which is nice. So yeah, hopefully things will progress at a nice rate and we'll be bigger and bigger before you know it.
Of course, no pun intended with your business getting bigger and bigger. And I digress by doing that. I'm sorry, the puns. So I know, right?
Enjoy a good pun. It's okay.
Exactly.
I was a middle school teacher, so it was.
Oh yeah, so you probably had like the dad joke puns going.
Lots
too.
Of puns and dad jokes. Oh yeah, 100%.
Of course. And I completely threw my train of thought off too, which is by making that joke. How did you come about, like, what is the behind the name Brass Monkey Bread Company? Like, what?
That's a great question. I actually came up with the tagline first, which is, breads and baked goods to warm your soul.
Okay.
And my friend Josh, who just passed in November, I called him and he helped me kind of pick the name out. And at first I thought, you know, oh, it's the Beastie Boys. Yeah, I love the Beastie Boys. You know, I saw the Beastie Boys in 1994 and the Roots opened for them at the Civic Center in West Philly. And it was amazing. And he goes, no, it's not actually what it's for. I took your tagline and I found something. It's like an old British saying, cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey. And so, right? But it's not those kinds of balls. They were cannonballs. There was a metal plate, and when it would get cold, there was a divot in it, it would pop, and the cannonball would fall off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it would pop up. And so the name was like, oh, it's kind of perfect. So people always think it's Brass Monkey, but it's actually secret, and it's more about like the bread's warming your soul and breaking bread with people and community and stuff like that.
That's beautiful. And I mean, I feel like that that's mostly like kind of what you were inspired by, like, because you started it back in 2020. And, you know, during the pandemic, when we were all trying to reach out and just stay connected with people that we love. So breaking bread with, you know, loved ones is definitely falling under that, you know, that umbrella.
Yeah.
Now I want to say,
yeah, absolutely. Community is huge for what we're doing too.
And I want to say the breads that you're creating are not atypical. They're not just sourdough breads or, you know, or cookies.
Right.
Like, so getting to like some of the creations that you come up with.
This past weekend I did a brown butter, caramelized, ramp with bacon and sharp cheddar loaf.
Slice that up and throw some like eggs
on
that.
You don't need anything, right? It's like,
you don't, but like if you make a breakfast sandwich out of that, just, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I just like, you know, I think of things that I like and I enjoy eating and I want to share that with people. And I want to do that through, I guess, what I know. I never thought I would be a baker. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a chef and my mom kind of talked me out of it and told me to go into education because I was really good with kids. And so I did that for a while. I was in it for almost 20 years and I was a teacher for about 15 years and it has taught me a lot, but it was definitely time to move on and do something different.
Yeah. But I mean, you found one passion and moved on to another passion. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
So now, obviously, like there's a lot of collabs that happen within the culinary community, especially in Philadelphia. Well, I mean, all over the place, but I know Philadelphia, like when you start getting into the culinary community, like-minded individuals kind of flock to each other and collaborations happen. So what are some of the collaborations that you have had in the past? And do you have any in the, you know, moving forward that you might be able to talk about?
Absolutely. One that I did in the past was with Mike's Barbecue before they sold. I used to do stuffed pretzels, stuffed sourdough pretzels. Mm-hmm. And so I got some of their brisket and I took some of their brisket and I put it in a pretzel with some Cooper Sharp cheese. And then people could choose either pepperoncinis or caramelized onions to go in it as well. And then, so that was a fun collaboration. I was eating it for like 2 weeks afterwards.
I mean, I wouldn't be mad at that either.
Barbecue sauce, like,
yeah.
And so I have another one coming, right? Like, it's so good. And Mike's is great. It's still great after they've sold. And one that I have coming up is with a woman who goes by Sexy Soup Dumplings on Instagram.
Okay,
and she's working on some char siu. And I'm going to do a chili crisp bread with, green onions in it. And then I take some Szechuan peppercorns and I, toast them and then I put them on the top. So it's like
Pops
a little bit sweet, a little bit spicy. And then you get like the little nummy feeling from the peppercorns.
Of course. I love that feeling too.
It's funny, at pop-ups, I do a schmear with it too. And then I have to warn people, like, don't call the hospital because this is normal.
Yeah. Like you're not having a weird experience. That is how you're supposed to feel that.
Yeah.
But it's delicious. Yeah. And you know, given that we just passed, I think National Pretzel Day was like over the weekend, I think Friday or Saturday. And so did you do anything to celebrate that foodie holiday?
I did not. I was prepping for my pop-up on Sunday, but I actually stopped making pretzels a little while ago just because I was having some nerve issues in my hands. And so the pinching got to be difficult. So I had to like prioritize what I was going to do. But now that I got some help, I'm ready to hopefully bring them back sooner than later.
Yeah. So now if somebody was to hire you to create some bread, because obviously you do pop-ups and we'll get into like where you're going to pop up in the near future, like in a little bit. But if somebody wanted to order bread or something from you, where would they, like, how would they get in touch with you?
So they can get in touch with me through my Instagram. It's at Brass Monkey Bread CO. I don't generally take orders per se. I mean, it's special events, things like that. Not necessarily for like a loaf, but I'm in 4 stores right now. Okay. A couple times a week. Herman's Coffee, Green Street Coffee. Holy Cannoli is a cannoli shop that uses my bread for their sandwiches. And then a shop called Sam Shaw's Treatery. They get bagels and loaves of bread once a week in their 3rd and South Street.
Okay. I mean, that's a popular spot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm looking to pick up a new account relatively soon. So be on the lookout for that news.
Oh, that's good. Exciting. Yeah. Exciting announcement.
Very exciting. I'm hoping it'll be like my biggest account yet, but we're working on it. So we'll see what happens.
All right. So now let's focus on like where people can find you, because you're obviously going to do more pop-ups. The weather's nicer. And so that availability to like go out to different places is going to become more frequent. So, you know, what are some of the pop-ups that you have or events that you're going to be catering towards with your brass monkey bread?
Yeah. So I do pop-ups almost every Sunday. generally I try to go to like places where, you know, people are friendly and whatever. So I'll be at Herman's this Sunday, on the 5th, and then it's Mother's Day. So I'm going to be hanging out with my mom. She's in the hospital right now getting her 2nd bone marrow transplant. So we've been spending a lot of time there. Thank you for the fingers crossed. She's doing well. She just turned a corner the other day. So we're staying positive and strong, and she's doing all right. And then I'll be at Stump in Bella Vista on the 19th, and then I'm back at Green Street on May 26th, Stump Northern Liberties, June 2nd, Weaver's Way Farm Stand, June 9th, and then it's Father's Day, so I'll be hanging out with my stepdad that day, and then the 23rd, I'll be at Salt and Vinegar on 9th Street in the Italian Market. Okay. And they are a super cool store if you haven't ever been.
I haven't. And you said that and I was like, ooh, I want to try to check them out because that just off the name.
It's really good. It's
So do you have like, I mean, given that Mother's Day is coming up and Father's Day is going to be, you know, right around the corner as well. But with the collabs and whatnot, do you ever create like specific breads or offerings of some sort that are geared towards the pop-ups?
I don't usually do holiday kind of things. Generally, it's like a place for me to test things, to try things out, to really like fine tune those, the recipes. We've been trying recently, we've been doing focaccia and we've been doing it a couple different ways. So we've done it like the last 3 weeks, we've done a tomato pie. This past week we did one with tomato and then I made a whipped goat cheese.
Okay.
And then I put that on there and then I drizzled it with, I gave them a choice of some local honey or some Mike's Hot Honey.
Of course. You know, not for nothing, Mike's Hot Honey is fantastic. Yeah. And across the board, if somebody is going to do like a hot honey, usually it's Mike's. So I have to say like that's
probably good. Phenomenal. Although I have to say that the person I get my honey from is it's Miller's Apiary. They're in Glenside and she makes a hot honey and it's also fabulous.
I'll have to try that.
Yeah.
So for our listeners out there, where can they find you online? Like, can they follow you or like personally, privately, or is the best way to get in touch with you is through Brass Monkey Bread Company?
Yeah, they can. I mean, I have a website. I haven't updated it. I've been living kind of on Instagram for the last 6 months or so. But Instagram is really the best way. I am in the stories all the time. I usually start posting about a pop-up the week before because I'm doing one every week. And sometimes I'll put up like a little banner and say, here's what I'm doing this month. But yeah, Instagram is the best way to keep in touch. I will respond to messages right away.
All right. Well, listen, Zach, it was wonderful having you on Food Farms and Chefs, and which our name might change soon. So just, you know, be aware of that. But thank you for joining us. And I wish you the best of luck. And I wish your mother quick healing with what she's going through. So,
yeah, thanks. I appreciate y'all having me. It was great.
All right. And on that note, we will be right back after a short break.
Join us on Food Farms and Chefs Radio Show, where we highlight everyone from top industry leaders to startups and the farmers who make it all possible with co-hosts Jean Blum and Amaris Pollock, with original episodes that debut every Tuesday at 6 p.m. on WWDB 97.5 HD2 and at WWDBAM.com. and on your smart speaker.
Hi, and welcome back to the newly established Food Farms and Chefs. I have on me, joining me, Brendan and James, who are brothers, but also co-owners of Tuckedito, which is a delicious Latin-based cuisine. Brendan and James, welcome to Food Farms and Chefs.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Now, no problem. Now, let our listeners know, because I was trying to research your history, and like there is your website is up, but there's not much on your history on how you guys came about owning this. So what drew you to owning this Tuckedito?
Go ahead, Brian. All right. So we came to starting this business more from like a want to start a business mindset rather than the food immediately. So my brother and I, we talk pretty much every day, and we worked corporate jobs before this, and we'd always be talking about different ideas that we could turn into businesses. And a lot of them required a lot of capital or just weren't feasible at the time. And eventually the timing worked out like in the pandemic, where my brother was moving home and I had the chance to move home, and he was living out in California before and trying to replicate a lot of the Mexican cuisine out there. And I went out to visit him a couple of times, and we both love tacos, and we'd be trying all the food out there. And then we had a party when he came home, and he made these taquitos. Well, our take on a taquito is not a traditional taquito, and the people loved them. And then from there, we basically said, I mean, a food truck's a feasible thing. We could start up low overhead and see how it goes. So kind of.
So James, would you say that you were the driving force behind the decision on what you would be serving, or is that just a collaborative effort? Since you also, Brendan, love Latin based foods too.
Yeah, I would say to start, I guess that was more me, because I mean, neither of us are like, you know, professional chefs coming from that industry, but I was definitely like more of a hobby cook. Like I enjoyed, you know, on my own, always doing that. But yeah, I guess I was the driving force probably in the food, but for once we started, then it's, you know, iterations are coming from every which way. But yeah, primarily maybe on like the food side of things. Yeah,
I would agree. We had similar ideas on like wanting to start a business, but I would say James was more the driving force on starting the business as well as like what it was. But
yeah. So yeah. Given that you don't have the culinary degree, although that doesn't necessarily supersede like what, you know, the success is for your business, or the fact that you're able to produce a delicious, you know, menu for people to choose from. Like, how was it adjusting to the volume? Because obviously, like, food trucks are like prevalent. Like, there was a huge food truck boom, and it's just, I feel like, continued to grow. People love food trucks, love food carts, the availability, the mobility of it. So what was it like kind of adjusting to the demands?
Yeah, I mean, you learn a lot right away. So, you know, you're cooking, yeah, large quantities of food at a time. It's kind of almost a guessing game some of the times when you're going out, like how many people you're going to serve. So it's, you know, you have a lot of different factors that play a part in it, you know, the weather, whatnot. So it's hard to predict that. But to get into like the quantities right away, we came from like, we want to start a business type angle. I like did a lot in Excel, Microsoft Excel for my career before that. So right away, my first thought is like, all right, I'm going to make like a tool that I can put in like how many people I plan to serve, and then it'll put in all our recipes, and then it'll spit out like, you need to buy this much, whatever, like meat, produce, all of that. And then you're going to cook this, and then, you know, you put in your different weights, and then yeah, it spits out like what you need to get, what you're cooking, and how much like food you need at the end to serve everybody. So we went at it from that angle. And then, yeah, definitely adjustments. We started out simpler with like the menu, and then you just tend to add more and you see what works.
Yeah.
So did you, I'm sorry, Brendan, you were saying?
Go ahead. I was going to just kind of agree with James and add on a little bit. We definitely learned a lot about cooking and making real batch sizes quickly. Like, so we came in, we both had a little bit of experience cooking. We both read, you know, the basic salt, fat, acid, heat, which is a great book, by the way. And then, you know, cooked on our own in the kitchen, like small batches, but then cooking for 150 people was so much different. And I remember like trying to scale our recipes up was a struggle. And then, as James said, over time we've improved. We started cooking with better ingredients. We've learned what not to use, what tools we needed in the kitchen. Like there's just so much to learn. So that almost made it more fun for me, honestly, coming in without much experience, because we learned quick. And I mean, we're still obviously always getting better, but it's just, you see more results when you come in not knowing anything, you know? So,
I mean, it definitely opens up a more creative, because I know that going through culinary, well, I don't know because I didn't go through culinary school, but from the chefs that I spoke with, you know, they learn technique and skill and whatnot, but they come out, and I've had numerous chefs say to me that they come out and it's kind of like, they eventually down the line become more creative, but when they first come out, it's very like regimented, like this is how you do it. This, you know, the technique, the skill. And so they kind of stick with, you know, what they know, but you're coming from a knowledge base of a blank slate. So your creativity like kind of abounds. Like, so what are some of the like maybe creative taquitos and tacos that you've come up with in, you know, that have been hits, some that, you know, maybe didn't take off? Like, what are some of your big sellers?
Well, the ranchero chicken taquito, which is just like it's almost just like a basic mild salsa, chicken and cheese. That's just, we've realized people love chicken when we're out. So it's always the chicken. That was like one of the first, I guess we had like basic menu that we went with, like, for the first 4 months. And that was like one of the first iterations was like making our own salsa for that. And then I guess a couple other things that we've tried different combinations. We usually try to offer a menu of taquitos and bowls is like that. We always will have that when we go out, and then we'll try to offer a taco special as well. One that we've been recently been trying to do is a black garlic birria. So it's like, yeah, it's a traditional, it's like a birria recipe, but obviously we're using black garlic, and it's more heavy on ancho chilies in the rub. So that's something, I mean, we just try different combinations. I don't think I wouldn't say we're experts in technique, but our minds work in weird ways where we're like, these things together, this sounds pretty good. So we more try like on that aspect.
Yeah, James has definitely put a lot of work into like reading Mexican tailored cookbooks or like history, authentic Mexican cooking techniques. YouTube, watching videos, you know, basically learning from other food trucks, other people that come from Mexico and have like cooked these recipes, and then, you know, just watching other people on social media, whatever it is. But James did put a lot of work into that, and then try to experiment based off, you know, it's combining things you've seen in different books, videos, whatever it is. And a lot of it turns out to be delicious, that's for sure.
No, I hear a lot of James doing a lot of creativity things. So Brendan, how do you put your signature into the dishes that you guys come up with?
I would say I'm more just like the consistency type of guy. I'm just in there getting what needs to be done. Like, so when we talk about volume, I'm the one dealing with the meats and the big batch sizes of whatever it is, rub and mixing things together. But I mean, creativity wise and recipe wise, James is definitely the one that's coming up with all of that.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot that goes into a business like that's outside the food, obviously. So the food is an aspect, but you kind of get that and you get that, you know, down pat, and then you have to book a schedule, you have to keep the books, you have to, you know, there's countless things to do, answering so many emails, the licensing, like that's event fees, staying on top of all that.
I make a lot of our house-made sauces regularly. I'm pretty good at them, but it's nothing. I can't give myself credit because it's simple stuff, really. I work on a lot of the other parts of the business more than James is more on focused on the food than I am. It's a team game, obviously, but we have to each have our responsibilities within the business. So.
Of course. And I mean, and it's a key component. And like you, James, were mentioning, you know, there are different aspects to it. And it does, you do need that balance, because especially if you're going to have somebody, you know, running the show creativity like wise, you need somebody who can balance and like, you know, deal with the business end. Because like you had mentioned, there's more that goes into it. Like you were mentioning the fees and the licensing and stuff like that. But, you know, one of the things that people don't, those are some of the things that people don't think of when they want to jump into the business. Cause I've had discussions with people where they're just like, I want to own a business. And I'm like, do you know how much actually goes into that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, owning a wrapped food truck, you know, with all the bells and whistles is still quite expensive. You know, so you have to know, you know, going out there and going within your means and your budgetary needs. So it's a key thing to really kind of look out for when you're, you know, starting a business up. And I'm sure you can agree to that. And I'm not trying to like.
No, well, 100%. I think a lot of people don't understand that. And some people will. We luckily, again, came at it looking into it as a business. We actually started off under a tent. So we used a tent and we had a rollout griddle and everything, because you wanted to. Like we had a set amount, we knew what we were going to put in, we had a budget. You don't want to take out too much debt and then get into the business and then realize, wow, what I'm making isn't paying off this debt and paying me enough to live, because that's how you go out of business very quickly. Yeah. So we did realize that, and going in, and it's always managing that. Like we're always keeping track of our food costs, making there like sitting at a percentage of sales that we're comfortable with and all of that. So you definitely, I agree. That's very important for people, because people don't think about that. And then that's how to get yourself into a position you don't want to be in.
Yeah. People think of the fun and the ability to be creative and try new recipes, but you don't get to do any of that if the business isn't profitable. So like we've been lucky enough to have been doing it for almost 3 years now and trying a lot of new stuff, but that doesn't happen if you're not making money, obviously.
Yeah. Now you said almost 3 years. Are you guys going to do anything to celebrate your third year anniversary?
We haven't done any of that yet. We actually, when we started, our first event was one of my like best friends from high school. They were running a 5K. They had been doing it every year for, I guess, 10 years and then they stopped, after. So we kind of, not even our second year. Our second year, they didn't do it either, but that was kind of going to be our, I guess, anniversary party. They just didn't have the 5K, so we just haven't had anything. But I don't know. It's at the end of September, so we still got some time. But
we got
there's some planning time.
Yeah, I don't think we've thought of anything yet, but
maybe we'll make it. We have some friends that play music, and we always try to get like pair up with them at a brewery. We're actually doing one at the end of August at 10/7.
Okay.
So. Yeah, they're an acoustic duo, so we like to get all our friends out and do that. So maybe we'll make that an anniversary party. It's a good excuse to do it.
Yeah.
Now, with the licensing, because I know that, you know, sometimes you can't go into different states. Are you able to, because you are clearly mobile, are you able to go outside of Philadelphia? Like, so say our listeners are living in Jersey or Delaware or New York, would you be able to travel to those individual states?
Licensing is done by a county in Pennsylvania. So, and other states, I think it's a state by state basis. We haven't tried to go to any other states or into it necessarily, but
for public events, it's by county, but you can go as long as you have your health license, you can go to like private property.
And,
you know, like if people are having because we do like, you know, a lot of graduation parties and stuff like that, since it's on private property, you just need like one license. But if you were to vend like on a public street, you need by county license.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. See, that's something that I didn't know. And I'm sure if somebody
we didn't when we started either.
Listening, who wants to start up a business, that they need to know that too. Yeah. But that's good to know too. And I want to also mention the fact that you offer like large quantities of your rubs and sauces and stuff like that. You're not just vending at different events or private events. You offer actual like take home, do it yourself kits. So let's delve into like the food offerings and some of the other stuff that you have going on.
Yeah. So we offer the taco kits, trays, sauces for pickup from our kitchen. So we just ran out a church for our commissary kitchen. You need another aspect. You need to have a licensed commissary kitchen to run a food truck. So we rent monthly from a school that's no longer in use. So we use their kitchen. So we offer for pickup from there. Taco kits, trays, all of that. That is a smaller part of our business because most of the time it's harder to coordinate because we're out. When we go out, we are like brewery menu, I would say, like our traditional menu is just like, we'll do 5 or 6 taquito flavors. We'll mix those up. And then we'll also offer bowls. And then we'll have 4 sauces on the side or sauces on the bowls. Usually for our bowls, we'll offer hibiscus, pickled onions, bell pepper, tomato, cilantro, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we'll switch it up, offer tacos. And then if people are booking us for private catering, which is a lot of what we're doing in this summer, we have how many different options is it, Brent? Six different packages, taquitos, bowls, tacos. So then whoever's booking us can choose like what package they want and then what flavors within that.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. So we have some options available for like pickup catering, but we don't do like hot pickups or deliveries yet because it's just us two and one part-time worker. And we're, like James was saying, we're more focused on the events than pickup catering.
Yeah. Now, have you done any collaborations? I mean, outside of like the breweries, like have you collaborated with any fellow food truck owners?
No, not yet. We haven't. We haven't done that yet. Just the brewery so far.
Okay. Because I feel like that you guys have a food truck or a food cart that has an avenue that can be playful with your flavors and your offerings. So I like
it is something. It's a good idea, and I've definitely thought about it. And it's one of the things that I think about. And then I feel like we get caught up in like we got to do this week, and then it's like it doesn't happen.
But yeah, we talked about it in the past. I can't think of specific examples, but I remember like a year ago coming up, but I love the idea because I love the community. I love all the people that we've run into since starting this business that are doing the same thing as us in the same struggle. There's so many friends we've made just from, you know, showing up at the same events over the years. So, it's something on the list. Yeah.
Now, I want to find out what are some of your favorite foods that, you know, you guys create? Like, are there anything or is there anything I should say that you're like my go-to if I'm like starving, like the one thing that triggers me that I have to have is this?
I mean, he's coming up with a new concoction every week that I like to try. But if I had to say like staples, mostly on the truck, I'm eating either a ranchero chicken or al pastor bowl with the hot sauce, the smoke. That's my favorite sauce for sure. But other than that, if I really got to choose, brisket and the birria tacos are my favorite by far with the salsa matcha. So those two. But
and James, what about you? What are some of your go-tos?
My go-to, I love al pastor tacos. When we're offering tacos, al pastor tacos are some of my favorite. Then I like the kick of chicken that we offer. Again, people love chicken. This chicken is, our mixes are kind of just like meat and then sauce and then cheese. And we kind of that's our, like, would be the primary base for like any taquito or bowl flavor. So we do the kick of chicken's that and then a jalapeno cilantro crema. So it's got a little bit of kick, but not too much. He's more of a spice guy than me. I can handle a little bit, but don't like it over the top. So that I'll go with that. And then I usually will go with the bowl. I love pickled onions on it. And I love salsa verde. We make the salsa verde fresh every time before we go out. So I'm always going for that.
Yeah, that salsa verde is my favorite too. So
best.
Right there with you. Yeah. Now I do love a little bit of spice, but not like super spicy. Not like although I have been known to like eat spice where it made me cry. It made me numb. and I just kept eating. Cause I was just like, but it tastes so good. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely somebody who loves a milder kind of spice. So, you know, I'd probably be right there with you, James.
Yeah.
But we run out of time actually quite quickly. So
yes.
Before I have to let you go, let our listeners know where to find you in person in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So if you just go to our website or Instagram, and it's Tuckedito, TUCKEDITO.com, or that on Instagram, that'll have our schedule for the month, 1 month out. And you can just check that out. Always available Instagram, DM, email for a private catering or any of that.
All right. James and Brendan, thank you so much for joining me on Food Firms and Chefs. And I will try to track you down because I know you're on roaming hunger as well.
Yes. Yep. Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
Yeah, no thanks problem. For having us. It was fun.
All right. Thank you very much. And I will look forward to meeting you guys in person.
Sounds good.
All right. See ya.
See ya.
To listen to the rest of Food Farms and Chefs, tune your HD radio to 97.5 WPEN HD2 or stream live from WWDBAM.com.